This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. foreign and national security priorities and challenges in 2020. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel, coming to you as we do every year at this time from the campus of Georgetown University, right here in Washington, D.C. As we enter 2020, the United States is in quite a different place than it was last year. After his impeachment by the U.S. House of Representatives in December, U.S. President Donald Trump is facing a trial in the Senate. The House of Representatives accumulated significant evidence that Mr. Trump used his office and leveraged congressionally appropriated foreign security assistance for his personal political benefit by attempting to coerce Ukraine, a foreign ally facing Russian aggression, to announce an investigation into a domestic political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. In addition, Mr. Trump asked for a probe of an unfounded theory that Kiev conspired with Democrats to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. In fact, incontrovertible evidence collected by U.S. intelligence agencies and Special Counsel Robert Mueller confirmed that Moscow interfered in the election. So, how will impeachment affect Donald Trump's foreign policy? Or will the fact that this is also an election year be equally, if not more central, in affecting the course of foreign policy than the cloud of impeachment? We'll ask our distinguished experts. Anthony Clark Arend is professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Previously, he served as vice dean for faculty and graduate affairs at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And Mark Lagon. He's chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And that's a Washington-based nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the goals of the Global Fund. A scholar and former ambassador, Mark previously served as president of Freedom House, one of the oldest and most prestigious organizations dedicated to defending human rights around the globe. And both join me here at the campus of Georgetown University. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
And thanks again for hosting us here.
Our pleasure.
Well, Tony Arend, let me begin with you. How do you think this impeachment investigation and, of course, the upcoming Senate trial will affect the Trump White House regarding foreign policy and national security priorities and their execution?
Well, it's somewhat difficult to say, and I think in large part because we are completely unmoored when it comes to foreign policy. What we've seen, in my view, is that the administration has been bouncing back and forth from different foreign policy initiatives, different efforts. There doesn't seem to be any kind of coherency in foreign policy. There is no real strategy. And I think this is complicated in large part because most of the individuals in the administration who were able to exert some kind of coherence have left, whether it's General Kelly or General Mattis or a variety of other folks. And as a consequence, what we really seem to see is the president bouncing back and forth between his pet projects, whether it's loving Kim Jong-un and hating Iran, loving Vladimir Putin and trying to pull off a deal with Zelensky. It's really unclear. And I think what the impeachment trial will actually do is make things worse, because as Trump responds by tweet to the events of the day, that could have an impact on what he thinks he should do in foreign policy. So it's hard to predict, but I don't think it's going to be a pleasant year as the impeachment trial looms in front of us.
How do you see that, Mark Lagon? You used to be a senior congressional staffer.
I was a congressional staffer at the time of the last impeachment. In fact, Lindsey Graham, who's one of the president's defenders in the Senate, was one of the people bringing the case from the House against President Clinton. The U.S. government managed to do its business at that time. It brought about a substantial budget deal to close the budget deficit. It pursued reform of welfare and social programs. And the question is whether that's possible today. Tony is right that there's a sufficient degree of chaotic patterns in foreign policy that it could devolve further. My own view is that it might not necessarily get any more messy, which is not to say that the situation is good now. There are some common themes that one sees, an antipathy by the president to champion human rights, except in a few unique cases of Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela. And he likes to have intense conflicts over trade. But in general, I think some of the chaos will continue.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at some regions, some issues. At the end of 2019, Tony, and beginning of this year, obviously, we saw rumblings in North Korea and Iran, North Korea threatening to, you know, test more missiles. And of course, Iran, we have the U.S. having struck sites in Iraq and Syria, which totally upended our relationship with Iraq, or rather, it certainly raised tensions. And of course, Iran now is threatening more action. How do you see these two particular incidents?
Well, I think the North Korean situation is very curious. Kim Jong-un made a declaration that he was going to have a Christmas present for the United States. And we didn't see anything that required significant unwrapping come on the 25th of December. However, we have seen Chairman Kim indicate that he is not going to feel bound by the restrictions on developing weapon systems, that he may move forward in tests. President Trump has responded rather modestly, saying, well, I trust Kim Jong-un. I take him at his word. We will see what happens. My feeling is that Kim is going to push the envelope as far as he possibly can. He's going to test Trump's, if you will, love for Kim and see what that actually leads to. I have felt for some time, despite efforts of the administration, that the North Korean regime has no intention whatsoever of limiting their nuclear weapons program. I feel the United States needs to accept the fact that North Korea is a nuclear weapons state and proceed accordingly. I feel like the administration is hoping something else will come about, and perhaps President Trump is hoping something else is going to come about by power of his personal relationship with Kim, but I don't think it's going to work that way at all. With respect to Iran, we have a different set of problems. I feel as though the United States' decision to launch unilateral airstrikes in the territory of Iraq without the consent of Iraq was a mistake, and we're starting to reap the consequences of that. I feel as though there's going to be pressure on the Trump regime to do more as Iran continues to protest and continues to challenge this, and I don't know what the administration will do. On the one hand, I think the president is generally reluctant to use force. On the other hand, there could be pressure on him to do something. I feel if the United States escalates, the consequences will be very bad, and that the United States should take a deep breath and try to work more closely with the existing government of Iraq.
Two comments on those. I think the United States looks a little desperate for a deal with North Korea, and the president being the first U.S. chief executive to set foot on North Korean soil since the Korean War was a sign of that. And the United States even helped block action at the UN Security Council recently to examine human rights abuses in North Korea, which the world community had managed to get onto the agenda there. John Bolton, having left the administration, even criticized that act from the outside as the former national security advisor. I think one bigger problem than saber rattling is stepping back from backing those who the United States has given their word to. Yes. And so leaving the Kurds out in the cold and stepping back from our commitments in Syria is a danger, is a sign of drift. People are looking still for leadership from the United States. There's something worse than a United States that is overly bossy in bringing together collective action. It's one that steps back.
I think that was a fundamental mistake when the Trump regime decided to not support the Kurds. I feel as though the United States has been acting poorly in that region for a number of years. We could go back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and say that that was a mistake, that that gave rise to terrorism, that gave rise to instability in Iraq and Syria. And then we could go to the Obama regime and look at the decision to draw the red line and not to follow up on that. And now we have the Trump administration doing the same kind of thing, failing to uphold our connection and our support for the Kurds. And the message it sends to the rest of the world is that you can't trust us. The United States' word is not meaningful. And I think that's a horrible message to send to the world.
There's possibility for collective action in the world. I want to give an example that is a source of hope, if I can. I work on AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. The Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria had a successful campaign to expand its funding. The United States and the UK during Brexit and Italy with its populist government and a whole battery of other countries increased their funding to fight these diseases and continue and buoy a possibility of saving 14,600 people estimated a day from those epidemics. The world community can come together, and the United States, on a bipartisan basis in Congress, backed that increase. Even in these worst of situations, collective action can happen. And despite walking away from the Paris Accord on climate change and from the Iran nuclear deal, there is a will in Western countries to cut across nasty partisan lines if only there's focus, as there has been, on AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria.
And I worry about some of those. I think that's absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, if we look at some of the global indicators of mortality rates and eradication diseases, things have actually gotten better in many respects, and I think you're absolutely correct. What worries me is that some of those issues are falling below the radar of our leaders, and in particular of the president and others. And when something sort of gets on the president's agenda, it becomes harder to get this kind of collective action taking place. And I'm not sure what we can do except to say we need to work in these areas and we need to hope that there may be some spillover into the areas that actually are on the radar.
Other leaders have had to step in. Japan stepped in when the United States walked away from the Asia-Pacific trade arrangement.
TPP.
The TPP, to help stitch together an arrangement which was pretty close to what had existed before, but sadly, the U.S. not at the table. And similarly, I saw President Macron host this conference in October in France for raising money for the Global Fund, and he challenged world leaders to step up, and they did. So there are partners ready to work with the United States if it shakes off the fog of this era.
We'll continue after the break. First, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Georgetown University professors Anthony Clark Arend, he's a professor of government and foreign service, and Mark Lagon, he's the chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and he also teaches here at Georgetown University. And we're coming to you from the campus of Georgetown University here in Washington. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter, and a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our loyal listeners and Facebook fans, Amara Henry from Uganda. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, since you brought up some positive news about countries coming together on fighting AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, I'm sorry to bring up a negative aspect, but of course we have a flow of refugees and immigration like we haven't seen since the end of World War II as a result of conflict, whether in Syria or other areas. So, Anthony Clark Arend, with this anti-immigrant sentiment which is emanating from the White House, particularly Mr. Trump ran on that, you know, building the wall with Mexico and so forth, that they would pay for, which hasn't happened and won't happen and so forth. But the fact that the United States is taking in so many fewer refugees and other countries in Europe are also weary and having trouble absorbing, that can't be a good sign.
No, I don't think it is a good sign. And I think you're absolutely correct. We've seen some leadership from people like Angela Merkel and others, but you're right in that Europe is becoming very weary of the crisis. The United States is not exercising the kind of leadership. I would actually point to a broader problem of which this is a part. And that is our support for human rights globally. If we think of the rights of immigrants, the rights of individuals to be free from persecution, to be free from oppression by the state, and we expand that, the United States has not stood up to a whole host of human rights violations that are taking place throughout the world. In China, for example, the treatment of the Uyghurs is absolutely unconscionable. Recent indication has demonstrated that not only are people being put in effectively concentration camps to be re-educated, but there's even been what some have described as cultural genocide, with evidence that China is destroying Muslim burial areas, Muslim cemeteries, in a way to wipe away this concept throughout China. We're not standing up to that. We're not standing up to the treatment of the Rohingya in Myanmar that is taking place. There's currently a case before the International Court of Justice on that, and yet the United States is not standing up to that, let alone the treatment of individuals in Russia or in Saudi Arabia or in Turkey or in the Philippines. And I think the American administration's attitude towards refugees is part of this whole process.
Indeed. And to you, Mark Lagon, I wanted to talk about the organization that you led many years ago, that is Freedom House. It has registered a decline in global freedom, fair elections, free press, individual and minority rights, like Tony just mentioned. And they also concluded, quote, the United States has retreated from its traditional role as both the champion and exemplar of democracy amid an accelerating decline in American political rights and civil liberties. We have a president.
I think those two phenomena are tied together, being an example and being a supporter of freedom, human rights, pluralism around the world are intimately tied together. And there are serious problems at home. Rule of law, whether it's corruption, basic norms, respecting requests of Congress for basic information being denied by the executive branch, these are fundamental problems. The image of the refugee or the migrant as the other rather than someone to be welcomed is a problem here. But let's face it, there is a problem elsewhere. In Europe, there is a growing populism, a questioning of the other, a coarsening of the commitment to protect minorities, and a turning inward, of which the United States may be the most acute case.
Indeed. And of course, we'll be looking at Brexit sometime at the end of this month. Another sign or consequence of this rise of nationalism and populism. Well, back to you, Tony Arendt. I want to talk about China, China's rise, notwithstanding what some critics call an overhyped trade deal with China. At least we have some understanding. But Beijing is asserting itself in the Indo-Pacific. It's meddling in Hong Kong, an area where we're seeing an incredible pro-democracy movement, which, again, the United States hasn't maybe supported in a full-throated way, but it hasn't at least turned its back to. But how do you see the rise of China this year, in particular as Trump is facing these challenges?
I feel like China's rise has been consistent over the past decade or so. And I feel as though the United States is not properly addressing it. And we could point to a whole host of things. The Belt and Road Initiative, we're not countering that. Ambassador Lagon mentioned the challenges that we've seen being presented by China in a variety of places. TPP, the United States is not entering into the Trans-Pacific Partnership and thus ceding some of the ground to China there. China's claims in the South China Sea, China's claims in the Arctic and a variety of other places, as well as its human rights violations. What we saw the administration try to do was enter into somewhat of a positive relationship, then engage in a trade war, which is supposedly going to produce a minimal agreement that we're supposed to see signed on the 15th of January. But it looks like that agreement isn't getting us any positive place. It's simply getting us back to where we started from. I don't think the U.S. has a strategy in general, but they don't have a strategy with respect to China. There were things that could have been done. I mentioned the TPP and others, but we're not following through on that. And frankly, China's vision of the world is not the vision the United States should support. It's not the vision that any democratic country should support, because it is a vision that is based on disrespect for human dignity and fundamental freedoms.
And also exploitation.
I think this connects directly to what you were raising before. The model that the United States and the West offer is shaky in the eyes of many people in the world. How it can deliver economically, whether it is solid against corruption, whether it looks out for all minorities and welcomes the least fortunate. It's incumbent upon the United States and the West to reclaim this model that democracy works, that democracy delivers for people, because China is offering an alternative model and one that is pernicious. As it invests all over Africa, it is creating privileged deals for its citizens, its workers, its access to resources. And it's offering tools of surveillance.
Correct.
Yes.
You know, it is not only the concentration camps and the treatment of the Uyghurs more generally in the Xinjiang province, but a brave new world, as we used to call it, of surveillance technology, facial recognition that China is sharing with others. We need to respond. Here again is a place that I do see bipartisanship when I talk to legislators, Republicans and Democrats alike. They know there is a problem with China and the United States needs to respond to the Belt and Road Initiative and this model China's offering.
And I would note, too, something we've all said before, but I need to emphasize the rule of law. The United States has been the paradigmatic example of the rule of law. Not that we haven't made mistakes, but the way in which we see members of the executive branch disrespecting the judiciary in particular is extraordinarily troubling. When judicial decisions are being dismissed by the president as biased, as insignificant, as not important, when judges are being called out by name, this is the kind of behavior we see in authoritarian regimes in other parts of the world.
Let's return to the findings of Freedom House. It says that it's most striking the backtracking of consolidated democracies, the United States, Hungary, Poland, Serbia, Israel, having backward movement on some of their basic freedoms. But still, Freedom House says that the most marked change is in the countries that are or already in the not free category, Russia and particularly China. Under Xi Jinping, there's centralization of power under one man, the greatest degree since Deng Xiaoping. And there is a commitment to a hardening of repression beyond the generically autocratic phase of the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000-aughts.
In addition to China, another beneficiary, that is another dictatorship that is being benefited, is, of course, Russia. It is on the rise in the Middle East. We have, in a sense, through the withdrawal of our support of the Kurds in Syria, and through ceding ground elsewhere, we are, that is the United States, in a sense, ceding ground to Russia. It is basically in charge in Syria, as is Iran. They are trying to break up Europe as we speak. They're trying to dismantle NATO. I mean, this is music to the ears of Vladimir Putin, this trend.
I think that's correct. And it has been something that we've really seen since Putin assumed power. I think the United States was aware of it. They were aware of the fact that we have to deal somehow with Russia, but they were also aware of the pernicious nature of Putin. What has been extraordinarily troubling is the president's personal connection to Putin. Standing at a podium in Helsinki saying that he believed Putin as opposed to the U.S. intelligence community, aside from demoralizing the intelligence community, the message that that is sending to Putin. And there's indication that Russia's talking points are being picked up by members of the administration, whether it's with respect to the Ukraine or with respect to other activities. And this is extraordinarily dangerous.
This is for a power, Russia, that does not have all the advantages China does economically.
Correct.
In fact, its reliance on traditional carbon-based energy is something that shouldn't be an advantage because of developments in the world of alternative energy and the United States' heyday of fracking for natural gas. But because of cannily using behind-the-scenes efforts to utilize social media to sow dissent in other countries and also being handed opportunities mm-hmm. by the West, most notably handing the initiative to Putin in Syria to essentially be Assad's patron and leave the scene.
I think this is an important point. Using this canny approach to causing problems, to interacting, to using social media, has increased their ability to be a disruptor state, and that's exactly what they're doing.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests and hosts right here at Georgetown University, Anthony Arendt, he's professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown, and Mark Lagon, chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.